Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome back to Colony, the official podcast. I'm Tara Bennett, your host and a senior editor producer for Sci-Fi Wire. We're digging into episode 3 of season 3, Mixed Signals. So as always, we'd like to welcome back the big brains behind the series, co-creator and executive producer Ryan Condal. Hello, sir.
How's it going?
I'm good. And then executive producer and word ninja, Wes Took. Hello, sir.
I'll take that.
Right. Yeah, it's good, right?
He always gets the better titles
than
I do,
I have to say. Well, you co-create, so, you know, you already have that big title.
She called you the big brains. Like, what do you need, really?
Well, you were included in that. You also get word ninja.
I didn't know if it was a semicolon or a comma.
All right, well, I'll step up my game for next time. But we also are very excited to welcome a first-time guest to the podcast and a new addition to Colony, Waleed Zewaider, who plays Vincent, who is seemingly, and I say seemingly because we don't know anything on this show until we see what we see, a sympathetic ally to the Bowmans at the new resistance camp. Hello, sir.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here. You're such a wonderful addition to the show. And Vincent is part of this brand new place, this resistance camp. We have never seen really an ecosystem of a resistance camp outside of what we've seen for the first two seasons, which was LA or one of the big blocks in the Los Angeles area. So when you guys were coming up with the Bowmans need to land, where do we want them to land? What do we want it to look like? What's going to feel kind of foreign, but maybe slightly what they expect too?
Yeah, I mean, originally, this camp was supposed to be in the desert. Turns out that Noah is, as we refer to her in the room, is environment blind. Because she had a lot of stories about the resistance camp out in the desert.
Yeah.
And we all had big talk and dreams of going into the Santa Clarita Desert before we found out that we were moving to Vancouver. So the idea was obviously to have it in a remote location.
Yeah.
So there isn't much desert up in British Columbia, but there is a lot of forest.
Yeah.
Looks like the forest moon of Endor up there. And we found this terrific old growth location,
yeah.
You know, deep into the woods. It was on a
second growth, Ryan.
Second growth.
They're very specific about their growth.
Yeah, yes. Well, that's actually very
get
true.
Right.
They all talk about it. Like, I see trees.
I see green bark.
I see trees and
we're
bears. But that place had a really interesting backstory to it. It was like a private-owned
Swiss
land. Yeah,
somebody's home,
land.
Right?
Yeah, and it felt like some kind of weird bunker that they were going to go to.
It was a quarter mile away from a shooting range, which is, for a sound environment, ideal, obviously.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And also very rare in Canada. We'll borrow a little home to everybody. But yeah, it was a terrific location, and the production design team built the hell out of it. It would have been a really cool theme park to keep open as a colony attraction.
The writers were living there for a little while, so it was nice.
Is that punishment?
Like,
did you have a bad draft?
That's how we break them in.
It seems pretty boot campy to me, so that works out nicely.
Better than the factory.
I mean, the concept behind it originally was we wanted to do something that was reminiscent of Castro in the Sierra Nevada.
Yeah.
Just because you've landed in a resistance camp doesn't mean that it doesn't have its own agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And you can feel that from the moment you walk in.
Absolutely. So when you're thinking about, all right, who do we have run this? You have the McGregor type, and then you've got Vincent. And so talk a little bit about creating the archetypes that you wanted running this place, and then we'll talk a little bit about how you came to cast Waleed.
Well, I think we should talk to Waleed a little bit about it because he was so instrumental in building out this character, and that our original conception of it was probably a little more simple than where it ended up. And you know, Waleed's first question coming into it was, who exactly am I? What do I believe? Where do I fall? Who do I follow?
Mm-hmm.
And by asking those questions, he forced us to think about the character in more complex and three-dimensional terms. I mean, we obviously want to keep things as one-dimensional as possible. So unfortunately, you know, sometimes good actors come in and ruin it for us.
Yeah. Well, when you did get the script, what was kind of the hook that was really interesting for you and posed those questions?
You know, when I got the script, and I got like the first, I think, five scripts at first, and I couldn't really find that many clues in there. I think I was trying to discover it myself as I was reading it. The first episode, Tim directed, right? He said something to me, And I can't remember if I had asked him something, or, but it was a clue into the character. And he basically said something to the effect of, I'd like to see Vincent's humanity.
Mm.
And that really stuck with me. And it kind of answered a lot of questions that I had had from reading the scripts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that just kind of grounded me.
Yeah.
Because the character is very conflicted and he's going back and forth constantly. So much so that I just found myself not really hitting my marks and just constantly like pacing back and forth and walking around. And the crew is just amazing because they were literally following me. It was probably the most conflicting character I'd ever played.
Yeah.
And so we talked a lot about the history of McGregor and Vincent's relationship and how that's changed over time. And when you have other exterior factors infringing on people's freedom and their survival, that really shakes things up. And then the Bowmans come in.
Yeah.
And what I do see in there that I think is really in the writing and in the casting, just the Bowmans and who these actors are, there was really a shared humanity there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why Vincent instinctively just latches on to them. And I think that there's a big part of them that's like, well, this is somebody we could really trust.
Yeah.
It really was a very organic process. It was just a lot of questions, a lot of confusion on my behalf. But, you know, it led to some really great natural transitions into how everybody kind of worked together.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see how the Bowmans are coming into this environment where Broussard was kind of the last person that they really felt like they could trust. And Vincent kind of walking them in and seeing something in him to let them go, should we even get off this train and go in there, is a big moment.
I mean, it's so helpful to have Waleed playing him as this clearly very humane, moral man caught in an impossible situation. There's a decency that he projects from the moment you meet him. And maybe Tim said something about playing him as an empath.
Mm.
You could kind of feel it, even in dailies, that just kind of shining through that this is someone who's trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
You sense that there's a history here and things are complicated, but ultimately, this is someone who did get into it for the right reasons and that Katie kind of innately figures it out. And Will knows enough to trust him enough to ask him a question on the way into the camp. And while he gives him that little kernel in episode two, which is going to be so helpful moving into episode three.
Mm-hmm.
It was also helpful for me. The very first thing I filmed was meeting the Bowmans and then instinctively meeting their children.
Yeah.
And for me, that was just like the perfect introduction to my character because I just naturally found myself going down on my knees and saying hi to their daughter, Gracie. That's, I think, just great storytelling.
And when they do come into this environment, McGregor, played by Graham McTavish, is a very different personality. So when, you know, this is, like you said, it's hopefully utopia for the survivors. They've figured out how to work amongst each other. But tell me about the evolution of McGregor, because, you know, when we first meet him, he's not the empath that Vincent is, and how you wanted to construct that and let us meet him.
It's actually very interesting. I think both characters were, whether from the outset or just very early on in the writing process, we actually wrote toward both Waleed and Graham. And mm-hmm. I'm not just saying that because Waleed is sitting here. I knew Graham from another project that we had done together and was always looking for something to do with him in Colony. And we were aware of Waleed for a while mm-hmm. and were kind of just looking for the right role to fit him into the show. And these both presented themselves in a way that both Waleed and Graham, you know, as people and as actors are so different. It just felt very interesting to put them together in this environment and see what would happen. I was kind of smiling as I was listening to Waleed try to puzzle through our intents on the show. And I think we get that a lot on Colony because if we were making the Americans here, I think everybody would come into the show instinctually looking for the kinds of things that Waleed got around to finding. It's because this is a genre show. I think a lot of people, because there's so much genre out there and because so much of it is a certain way, people come in expecting to play a comic book character, expecting that they're going to be mm-hmm. expected to play a comic book character. Mm-hmm. Whereas we try to have as much real actual drama as we possibly can on the show. I had the experience a lot where actors come into the environment and are sort of pleasantly surprised that they're going to be expected to play somebody that has
real humanity.
Yeah, contradictions, internal contradictions.
Layers.
And so, you know, somebody's conflicted and somebody that isn't expected to be all bad or all good or whatever. It was fascinating watching, you know, Waleed go through that process. And a lot of it was us going through the process together. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it we found, even in the editing, as mm-hmm. as you're going through and trying to dimensionalize this character, we didn't want him to seem weak.
Right.
There's a difference between being conflicted and being a weak character.
Right.
But there's somebody that can really be torn back and forth between two points. Obviously, living out in the wild there, it's a very stressful environment. You're worried about the people that you're responsible for. You're worried about your family. You're worried about your own safety. And at any moment, this can all come crashing mm-hmm. down. So I think playing into a lot of that and seeing how they're very different. Graham on the other side of the spectrum is very, very assured, very hardline in his stance. And his character started from the point of view of, what if one of these doomsday prepper assholes was actually right.
Exactly.
And we just started the character from that point and went from there. And that obviously necessitates a really strong actor who can come in and play that role, because if you don't cast it right, you could end up with something very arch. And
very.
You know, I mean, that's what we love about Grant. You would never know it from the roles that he plays on television.
I know, he's terrible.
Son of
all the
Killers.
On, Dougal on Outlander.
He's so, even on the thing he worked on with us, he was like the muscle, basically the mm-hmm. gun for the main bad guy. He's always so mean. And he really is the nicest man
you've
ever met. But he just, you know, he has a certain look about him and he's very frightening, even when he's being nice.
And that was the contrast we were looking for. To survive in this environment, you have to have known what you were doing and have a vision and a clear objective and a goal.
Yeah. Right.
And he's not really that interested in morality or the finer points of humanitarianism.
Yeah, black and white.
Right. So pair him up with someone who is very moral and very conflicted, we thought would be an interesting arc.
Yeah.
I remember, like, after a few episodes, Graham and I working together, I think the running joke was that we were the mom and dad of the camp.
Yeah.
And I was the mom and he was the dad.
Yeah, that makes
sense. And like it was really funny, but it was very, very real. He also, as an actor, is like Ryan was saying, he's very, very confident, very sure of himself. I don't think I've ever been intimidated as much with another actor
really
on screen as with Graham, because he just has such an incredible, powerful presence.
Yeah.
And, you know, it really just helped me in terms of what Vincent's through line was.
Once you got into the shooting of it, obviously TV is a brutal pace and you don't get an opportunity to rehearse very much or to kind of figure out how you even block yourself amongst somebody like Graham's character and how do you stand near him? What is the reaction? So tell me a little bit about whether it was in the rapport of you offset and you guys figuring out how you guys played with each other's energy, or was it really led by once you get onto a scene and you guys really feeling how you needed to orient around each other? Was that a director call or you guys just kind of worked it out?
The beauty of that was in the casting, and mm-hmm. just like what Ryan and Wes were saying, just in our different energies, mm-hmm. because I think there was even one scene where it was the three of us, Graham, myself, and Peter Jacobson, and when you have a scene with three people with three very strong personalities and everybody has their own vision of the scene, there was even more tension and struggle in there. And at one point, you kind of really have to give up that control to the creatives and to the director and take that guidance. But it really was really feeling it out throughout. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a lot of times that my instincts were right, but then there were times my instincts were wrong. And you have to be open to mm-hmm. that. It really was a very organic process, and you have to just really surrender to what's really happening there.
It's a good metaphor for the Bowmans, too, because they really kind of have to surrender over to this environment and figure out, all right, all of them. Bram's kind of figuring out his way. I love that scene with him and Snyder where he's like, yeah, it's not my first camp. You know, it's I got it. We all have to work ourselves out, and it's really telling of that, yet again, here's a new environment that everybody has to figure out, how do we orient ourselves? But there's an agenda, especially with Katie and the gauntlet and saying, we're here for a reason. And so, you know, when McGregor really pushes and wants her to give all of her information first before he gives her even a little bit, that's a really interesting place of pushback about what the Bowmans are going to do and a big decision as to, they may feel a little bit of trust with Vincent, but what do we feel about this McGregor guy?
We've had a lot of camps on the show now, so we label them in the room with either a smiley face or a frowny face or an uncertain face. So this is uncertain face camp.
The emoji with the teeth looking like, ee.
That was Hudson's camp, I believe, was the indifferent camp. We don't know what it is.
Yeah. Hopefully a smiley face camp.
Yeah. It's apparently a camp where you go on to huge commercial success and end up in every movie and every commercial on television.
We should all go to that camp.
Yeah, that's a good camp. Yeah, that's a big smiley face camp. Yay!
I'm not an actor, so I can't really speak to this, but it felt very much that, to tip the cap to the production team again, mm-hmm. that building the camp out in the woods, where some of these scenes, it's raining, you're in a second growth forest, the floorboards are creaking underneath you, there's pinging off the top of the huts.
Right.
There's value to that. Mm-hmm. And you're spending all day, you have to drive out of Vancouver, and you're on kind of a dirt road in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. The immense amount of work that they put into realizing this environment paid off dividends. As you say, we're shooting incredibly quickly.
Yeah.
But if you walk into a cabin that looks like a cabin, and you walk down a muddy path, looks like a muddy path, it's helpful to everyone, and they did such a great job of realizing that environment.
In the parallel storyline, you've got Broussard and who I'm still calling Dispatch. They're on the road now, and they are moving towards the resistance that Dispatch has talked about. We meet a family that they first come across who are in desperate need of medicine, and it's kind of a moral question. It's really kind of a test for both Broussard, who is not trusted and has been so independent living by himself for quite some time after the Bowmans left, and then we've got this new factor in his life that he's certainly embarking on the road journey, but is he really there with her mission, and does he trusted. So tell me a little bit about what you guys really wanted to explore as we get to know them together, operating together in this portion of the episode.
Yeah, I mean, we wanted to pair Broussard with an equally strong character and personality. Mm-hmm. And Broussard, throughout the course of his arc thus far, has encountered a lot of non-resistance people, mm-hmm. or non-soldier people, citizens, civilians, that he has trained up to be soldiers.
Yeah.
Whereas Amy comes into his life, played wonderfully by Peyton List, as somebody that is already a resistance fighter. And she certainly doesn't have the kind of military background that Broussard does, few do. But she's fought and likely killed and seen people die and all that. So it changed the dynamic between the two of them. He's not doing the, let me tell you about the resistance business,
right.
You know, Sonny. With Amy, it's more of a, they find themselves on similar footing. But also, Broussard is horribly lonely and doesn't trust anybody. So when she just walks into his Homeland Security office there, where he's shacked up with this story about dead resistance fighters,
yeah.
and we have to get out of here, you know, he's naturally suspicious. But Broussard has gone through such incredible loss and sacrifice, I think, over the course of the two seasons, that he feels at that point the need. He's been living in such isolation for so long. He certainly knows her voice, mm-hmm. from their relationship over the radio, that he just throws in with her. And
right.
he takes this leap of faith that I don't think previous incarnations of Broussard ever would have taken,
yeah.
which puts their relationship off in this really interesting footing. And it doesn't mean he's going to now just trust her implicitly as far as they go, but it shows an evolution in the character, and it mm-hmm. shows that this guy realizes that I have to throw in with other people. I have to be able to stand next to other soldiers and trust them to a certain degree in mm-hmm. order to A, survive, and B, to continue this fight that I've dedicated myself to fighting.
Because of the way we jumped the Bowman story, which was putting them on a train,
right?
Because we didn't want to be redundant with showing things outside the wall, this is our one opportunity to show our audience what is going on,
right.
kind of in the Great Central Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And we had this opportunity, being up in Vancouver, to also explore environments that we'd never been in before. Mm-hmm. So we were able to drive 4 hours east to Kamloops and get some great scopey epic shots
yeah.
that we've never had before.
Do you hire the drones to be your drone photography? Like, you know, if you're not busy, just shoot this for us.
Who's yeah. going to tell Tara they're not real?
Oh, damn it. See, you guys are so good.
Unlike shooting in L.A., the supposed home of Hollywood and the film business, where you can't use a drone unless you literally clear the population of the city out,
right.
because, you know, it'd be very dangerous if that thing ever fell out of the sky and happened to fall on somebody's head or whatever. The regulations in L.A. are ridiculous.
Yeah.
And in Vancouver, you find yourself in situations where you can actually get those drones up in the air.
Beauty shots.
And we've always wanted those shots in the show, because obviously there are a lot of drones in the show. The POV feels unlike any other shot
yeah.
that you get. It doesn't feel like a helicopter shot. It doesn't feel like a crane shot. It's very specific, and it feels voyeuristic and
mm-hmm.
intrusive the way that it floats. So we were able to do quite a bit of that nature shooting up there with our real drones.
You do get a 45-minute safety talk on the drone before it launches, where you're standing around this thing and they're talking about the death that can befall you if it falls from the sky, and you're
yeah.
looking at a 2-foot-long plastic piece of equipment and just
yeah.
staring
yeah.
at the grip.
Right. At one point on the waterfall scene, that's when we had the drone. They said, listen, okay, here's the safety thing. It's like, if anything happens with the drone, you and Graham just jump into the woods. Just jump into the bushes.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay.
Yeah. yeah. What, is it going to turn on us?
Right,
is it
yeah,
like, has it not been properly trained?
It's a sentient,
it's
angry
like, yeah, do
drone.
Not taunt Happy Fun Ball.
We had one drone season 2, which was amazing, which was, we finally got the permit. The permit was late. We had a 15-minute window to shoot the drone.
Yeah.
The guy says, great, launches his drone and flies it directly into a wall.
We're
just staring at this crumpled piece of equipment like, well, it's not drone season, is it?
Yeah. It only cost the production $65,000, so I feel like we got out of
it. Awesome. You guys, totally on the positive side on that one. Well, let's finish up with some of the amazing alien. We basically get a lot of revelations in the last part of this episode when we finally get to use the gauntlet as the translator, basically, for the rap that they have at the camp. And we get a conversation, which is very unexpected. Tips up what Snyder has already kind of let Will know about. Tell me about how much you want to show, because that's always a big decision. You know, what do we say? How do we portray it for the first time? Tell me about that huge scene.
We have to credit sound design here, first of all.
So good.
We are terrified about this because, you know, you're finally putting the shark on the screen. And if it's lame, everyone's going to hate you.
It's true.
And they just did an amazing job of making that feel cool and different. And, you know, there's been a lot of work obviously done in this area to make it feel distinctive, yet not kind of comic booky was,
right.
I thought, just amazing, amazing work.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this really kept us up at night. I mean, we had to execute this on a level that was cool and satisfying
mm-hmm.
and different and unique. And without, you know, we don't have a Westworld budget here.
Yeah.
So how do you do that? And how do you do that in an environment where we've seen a lot of this stuff? You know,
right.
we talked a lot about Arrival. I mean, that was just a great movie where you have a similar thing going on, but it couldn't look like that. Even though that was a smaller movie, we didn't have anywhere near those resources either.
Right.
So the trick was to do something, as we've done a lot on the show, is within these constraints, what can we do that's really cool? And I think the big breakthrough there was that obviously we knew that the rap was a machine. We've known that from the outset. And then the discussion becomes, well, how would a machine communicate? And
right.
how would it? We talked about the actual things that it was saying in the speech, the words that it's choosing. And we talked about it as like, if you were to like crouch down over an ant hill and then try to speak ant to the ants to try to get them to understand. Because it is artificially intelligent. Or however you want to class it. It's a machine from an extraterrestrial place that does have an intelligence, but it's now trying to speak to primitive
fleshy dopes.
Beings. And so it's trying to find words that we will understand because in its traditional day-to-day life, it doesn't speak. It communicates electronically through the ethers. So watching it try to find those patterns and get into our heads. And I think the big breakthrough there, just from a presentation standpoint, a sound design standpoint, was the idea that it speaks back to you in your own voice, in a, like an electronically representative version of your own voice, which is just, it's so creepy and intrusive that I think all of that together, really, really proud of how that scene came out. And if you saw the original version before any post-production brushes were applied to it, it was terrifying. Terrifying to the people that created it, I think, more than existentially terrifying the way it is now.
Well, it's a huge acting challenge also in the sense that you're standing in a room with a prop. And the prop is giving you key details that the audience is probably interested in, but as an actor, you need to find a way into it.
Yeah.
So to me, the success of the scene depended on you're relying on knowing enough about the characters to know how this information is going to land on them.
Yep.
But for the actors who were in the room and were doing such a beautiful job of communicating that they're not just asking questions, that there's an emotional impact being carried to the responses is, you know.
Yeah, it is an exposition scene, but it's an exposition scene with layers and character and
consequences.
Right. And McGregor's not very interested in getting the truth out of this thing as he is in it giving him confirmation bias.
Yes.
Right. So it came off incredibly well. Yeah. I mean, you know, that I would tell you that like there are a couple times on the show where I've taken my WGA card out and the large novelty shears just ready to just chop it into pieces.
This is it. I'm done. And, I'm over.
I think the dailies on that scene were that. And I was just like, well, here we go.
Oh, God. Power in a quarter. In terms of being in the moment and obviously, you know, you've worked on a lot of genre shows. Is it really one of those moments where you really hope the energy of all of the actors around you, you all are just in the same place of being in your imaginary zone?
In that scene, we all shared the same sentiment was, I think each of us was asked to pre-record our voice to use in the filming of it. Mm. And that really helped because hearing your own voice speaking back to you from this machine really did a lot of work for our own imagination. And then we were in it together. So I think we just naturally kind of bonded in that way. And then there was another scene that I had where I think it was a lot of visual effects, but it was when I have more communication with the rap and then it becomes very visual. And then you just really have to imagine exactly what is happening there.
Well, it was a great scene. It's a great way to end the episode. I want to thank all of you, as always, for being here and giving us the inside tip on everything. And thank you, Waleed, for being our newbie. Thank you so much for bringing Vincent to screen. He's so awesome.
Thanks for having me, and thank you very much.
See you next time.
As always, thank you so much for listening to Colony, the official podcast. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a review, like, subscribe on Art19, iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, whatever your listening place of choice is. We'd love to hear from you and let others know that you like what we're doing. We are gearing up to ask some fan questions. So if you've got something you want to ask Ryan or Wes or perhaps one of the cast members, even from a previous episode, we are happy to ask that as we move forward. Make sure you put comments on the bottom of our blog at scifiwire.com or find me on social media, which is my handle on Twitter at Tara D. Bennett. Use hashtag ColonyCast or just let me know how you think we should move forward with the show. We'd love to hear from you. And as always, our show would not sound as awesome as it does without my wonderful team, producer Bartley Taylor, producer-editor Paul Terry, mixer and master Dave Draper, and our engineer at the network studios, Mike Cassantini, as well as Trixie, the board operator. So thank you guys, as always, and we will have you back with us next week.